Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Markita Fornoff, producer for NPR News with Carrie Miller. Today, I'm speaking with Manal Asharif. If you don't recognize that name, maybe you've heard her described as the Saudi Rosa Parks. There isn't a public transit system in Saudi Arabia. Instead, Manal Asharif earned that nickname by getting into a car and posting a video of herself driving to YouTube. Within hours, the video had over 700,000 views. She was arrested, imprisoned, and eventually released. She wrote a book about her experience called Daring to Drive, and she joins me today from New York City. Manal Asharif, welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Markita.
So one of the most fascinating parts of your story is that you weren't imprisoned for breaking the law, but for rather breaking urf, or tradition.
True.
Can you explain a little bit more about what that is?
So there is no actual law in Saudi Arabia that criminalizes the act of driving while female, as funny as it sounds. It's mostly custom in Saudi Arabia that women cannot drive. And even if you go to the traffic police, apply for a driver license, they say you can't get one. So we still don't know who to blame. Is it the system? Is it the, because the system still is not illegal, but at the same time, they won't issue a driver license. And believe me, even if there is a law criminalized driving, I will challenge that law because it's unjust law.
I loved reading the part in your book where you're talking to the police and you're asking them why you're imprisoned. And they say, for driving while female. And I think you sort of rattled their cages a little bit when you were able to cite the specific section of the traffic code and point out that Yes. There was no written stipulation about driving and gender.
Yes. So they were like, wow, you're well prepared. I said, of course, I couldn't start this movement without being well prepared to answer these questions. And I did apply that day. I said, give me a driver license. This is the application. And he was just like, keep your papers. And I did take them to the court. And when I left jail in November, I took them to the court. And I said, there is nothing legal. It's not based on law. Why are you not issuing me a driver license? They sent the court case to a special committee. And for the last 6 years, we never heard back from them.
Mm-hmm. And I think we should be clear here that it's not as if you didn't know how to drive. You did have a valid driver's license, but in Massachusetts.
Yes. So I worked for 1 year between Massachusetts and New Hampshire, where I got my first driver license, actually, in New Hampshire itself. And then I got my second one in Massachusetts. So when he said, you cannot drive, you don't have a driver license, when they arrested me, I said, this is my driver license. And he said, but you don't have a Saudi driver license. And I told him, but you don't allow me to get a Saudi driver license. So for driving in Saudi Arabia, if you get a driver license from one of the GCC countries, UAE, I lived there 5 years, I got a driver license there, you can use it in Saudi Arabia, except if you are a woman.
Mm-hmm. And you learned to drive in the States. And when you moved back to the Saudi, driving wasn't just a matter of kind of missing life behind the wheel. There is like a very specific incident that made you determined to drive again. Can you tell us what happened the night you had a doctor's appointment that ended really late and you were trying to hail a cab?
So let's go back. I have a car. Mm-hmm. I bought a car in 2007, mm-hmm. and I paid the loan for the car for 5 years. I finished it in 2012 when I started the movement. In 2012, and I got my driver license in 2009 at the age of 30 in New Hampshire. When I went back, so I have a car. I paid it for 5 years, and it's sitting there. I can only drive it inside a walled, a gated community, and I have a driver license. And when I took, every time I go to the city, I get so much difficult time to find someone to take me back home. And that night when I went to my doctor appointment, it was 9 p.m. when I finished. I couldn't find any taxi to take me back home. And I was walking in the street, almost got myself kidnapped. I was harassed. I was crying like a kid. I was 32 years old and crying in the street. I felt so humiliated. one of the cars that followed me, I had to throw a stone. I picked up a rock from the street. It was a construction area where I picked up the rock and I threw it on him. That feeling of humiliation, that feeling of frustration was one of the main reasons, really. It was actually the straw. It wasn't the main reason. It was actually the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of those other reasons. I mean, it's a significant financial drain for women to use car services that frequently.
Yes. So in Saudi Arabia, we don't have a taxi system, for example. Here in New York, I just wave to a taxi and there is a meter. So the taxis don't have a meter. You have to bargain with them. We have to exchange the numbers of the clean taxis. Only the last 2 years, they started Uber. And even Uber, 83% or I think 84% of their, they said this, of their customers are women. So this shows you the gap that we have where women find jobs, women go to school, but they don't find a way of transportation in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and one of the parts you discussed in the book, you were describing that customer service is not necessarily high on their priority list. I mean, there were unpleasant smells, there was unwanted flirting. And some of the men, I think this is what shocked me the most, was some of the people driving did not have license themselves.
Yes, yes. Oh, in Saudi Arabia, because women don't drive, we have some of the highest fatalities in the world. And they allow minors as young as 10 years old to drive the cars because the mom cannot drive. She allows her son. And the traffic police turns a blind eye on minors driving cars who don't have a driver license, who didn't receive any education. I had to go to school for 2 months in New Hampshire before I could apply for just the written exam and get my driver license. This is not the case in Saudi Arabia when it comes to men, Saudi men, when they apply for driver license. My own brother, he didn't even do the test. He knew someone there. He got the driver license. And I'm like, what? And I go around and I ask my colleagues at work. I'm like, how did you get your driver license? He said, I know someone. I got it. I'm like, you know someone and you got it? If it's not my own brother who this mm-hmm. happened with him, I wouldn't believe they did this. So us as women, we get criminalized, punished, arrested, sent to jail for driving, while those men, they don't have that restrictions when it comes to getting good education, I mean, good training on driving. Bringing drivers from overseas who don't speak Arabic, don't speak our language, don't speak even English, and driving our car, he never saw a car in his life. He go take a crash course in the street, and then you give him a driver license to drive our kids and drive us as women. Mm-hmm. And that caused a lot of... Imagine, you're the one in the back seat, and I was the one directing my driver to go left and right, or to mm-hmm. this is a stop sign, you have to stop. I was educating my own driver while I could be in his seat driving my car. And in a country where the separation between the sexes, between the men and women, is so... in everywhere, in mosques, in hospitals, in banks,
in dining
public
rooms,
offices, in restaurants. Mm-hmm. There is a single separate entrance for singles and families. And then you bring a perfect stranger and ask me to host him in my home, have him driving my own car, have him have my own number, who is a perfect stranger. You force me to live with this man for hours in my car, driving me around. This contradiction is really huge in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the fatalities you mentioned a couple minutes ago, because you're not just talking about people dying from traffic incidents. There are occasions where houses were on fire, but the firefighters were unable to enter because there were only women inside and there was no male guardian present.
Yes. So there is a guardianship system in Saudi Arabia, and the mahram. The concept of mahram is any man I cannot marry. He's called my mahram. But the guardian is also a mahram, but he is assigned legally to give me permission to live, to exist, to be a citizen. In Saudi Arabia, if you don't have an emergency time, as you mentioned, if you don't have a male present in your home, the police will not enter the house. If you don't have, for example, I'll give you an example of a lady, a student who died because they won't allow the ambulance. Because the ambulance, there are men driving it. Mm-hmm. They said, they couldn't have doctors or nurses who are female. I said they could. But the driver, the problem is that the driver is a male. They won't allow him to access the campus, the university campus, because we have, of course, separate universities, girls and boys universities. And she died. And two cases happened in the last 2 years. How many girls we have to lose until these stupid rules change?
Mm-hmm. So you decided, all of these things in mind, that you were going to do something crazy. And you have sort of this tradition where you do, and you call them crazy, where you do crazy things on your birthday, like going skydiving. And then was it 2011 when you decided for your next birthday you were going to drive?
Yes. I posted online and I said, so what would be, because I was so frustrated after the incident that happened in the street when I almost got kidnapped. And I was so frustrated when I knew that there is no law. And I said, so, you know what? And the Arab Spring actually was happening in 2011, where I was really inspired by the youth using social media to call for a day of action. And I'm like, you know what? We can call for a day of action where ask women to drive. And I'm going to drive. I'm going to post it on YouTube to prove that we can do it.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good moment here to mention that if anyone had met you as a teenager, you would probably be the last person they would have suspected to become a crusader for women's rights.
True.
Can you describe how kind of strident you were as a teen?
When we are teens, we really have this crisis when it comes to finding our own identity, when we look who we are, when we try to discover what's the thing that really makes us tick and passionate to fight for. You know, all of us as teens, we were there, we're still lost. And it was easy to indoctrinate. Thank
mm-hmm.
you. So it was very easy to indoctrinate the youth mm-hmm. with the preaching, with the ultra-conservative teaching that we were going through in schools, and with all the wars that was going around us in Afghanistan, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Chechnya, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It was huge for us. It was huge fueling for us to call for jihad, to call for following God and being crusaders for Islam. So I was brought up in that atmosphere in the 80s and the 90s. So I think it was just natural that my generation went through that. We call it the sahwa or the awakening. Period in Saudi Arabia.
There's one line that really highlights this in your book. You say, quote, "At first, I pitied my less enlightened parents and siblings. Then I felt superior to them, poor sinners that they were. Then I lost patience with their unwillingness to see the one true path and resorted to threats, intimidation, and yelling," end quote. I mean, you even went as far as to melt your brother's Backstreet Boys cassette in the oven because the music was considered haram.
Yes.
Recording sermons over other musical cassettes of his that you found.
I apologize to my brother, really. I caused so much pain for my brother and my sister and my mom and my dad growing up with that mentality. When we were watching TV, I would just go and turn down the music. But we were taught that these things are haram. And these things sent you to hellfire. And then you see your own beloved people, your mom and dad, and thinking like, oh my God, I'll be in heaven and they will be in hellfire. This was the mm-hmm. ideas that come through that small mind of mine. I was, I think, 14 years old when I became extremely radical. I even hurt myself by locking myself, by reading only certain types of books, and I'm a vicious reader.
Mm-hmm.
I love drawing, and I had years of sketchbooks that I went upstairs, the rooftop of our apartment building, and I burned my own sketches. Mm-hmm. You have no clue how much I regret doing these things, but I was thinking I'm pleasing God.
Yeah.
I'm following God's orders to do these things.
Yeah, because your sketches were of animate objects, correct? That's why
yes.
they were haram?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so at that point in your life, you were aware of the 47 women who decided to drive in Saudi Arabia in 1990, but you didn't see them as heroes, but rather as heathens or infidels.
Yes. Yes. Those brave women who drove in 1990, it was the first protest, men or women, that happened in my country.
Mm-hmm.
And they were arrested. And the news that spread around them was totally false news. They took off their hijab, they burned it, they were dancing in their cars with the American troops because 1990 was the Gulf War II, mm-hmm. where we had a lot of American troops. They had so much anger, the extremists in Saudi Arabia. They had so much anger for having American troops and international troops presence on our land. And I think they found a way to vent this anger on these 47 women. And it was very spontaneous thing because we had the Kuwaitis coming to Saudi Arabia and they were driving their cars, the Kuwaiti women. They were driving their cars in the streets of Saudi Arabia. It was like, you know what, we can drive too because I know how to drive. The story that we got was totally distorted. So I grew up thinking that those women are to be blamed for that we could not drive until this day. And it took 21 years for me, from 1990 to 2011, to know the true story. When I sat with someone who knows these women, who told me the story, and I was in shock. I met them in person. They published their own book now, which is the November 6th. It was the day of their driving. And I'm so happy they published the book after the movement, the 2011 movement, Women to Drive movement, because finally we have the courage to go up and speak up and say, this is wrong what's been said about me. I'm here to speak for myself, and this is my true story.
You also note September 11th as a turning point in your mind where you started to begin to rebel against the teaching of hatred and hostility toward non-Muslims.
Yes. So September 11th was really one of the turning points in my life. And I talk about it in my Oslo Freedom Forum speech where they called me traitor for saying a very, for being blunt and saying very obvious truth. That year, so for me, the jihadis are heroes. And so many jihadis went to Afghanistan and Chechnya and Bosnia and Herzegovina. But then you tell me those jihadis go and kill civilians. That was huge for me because for me, they were freedom fighters. That was the turning point for me. To see civilians suffer and being killed, they're not in a battlefield. Why did this happen? And Saudi Arabia divided that year between people who are happy that this happened and people were in deep shock and questioning every single belief they have. And that was very sad to see someone being happy for the death of civilians. And that really brought Saudi Arabia to questioning and shaking their belief of hate against the non-Muslims or the people who don't follow the Wahhabi Salafi Islam or version of Islam. That was, I think, the turning point for me and for millions of Saudis.
Had that moment not happened, do you think you would have had that shift in mindset, I guess, to get more people willing to be involved with Women to Drive?
So Women to Drive happened way later, 10 years mm-hmm. later from yeah. this to September 11. But it's the whole time when you start moving from the city where you are, like Mecca, and then I moved to Jeddah, then I moved to Dhahran where I worked in Aramco. And Aramco, we had over 60 nationalities from all over the world. And I got married, I got divorced. And then I moved to live in the compound where people living around me from India, they're Hindu, and from Scotland, and from Philippines, and from America, from Texas. Those were my neighbors, and we're living in harmony. And I'm like, so why we have this problem with the other? Why we have this hate against the other? Why we dehumanize the other? So all these questions happen as you grow, as you leave your country, as you move out of your comfort zone, I think. It does change the belief system. And it doesn't happen only to Saudis. It happens anywhere in the world mm-hmm. when you move, when you... like now there is this hate speech against the Muslims around the world, which is very hurtful because you're using the same concept that those extremists were fighting them back home, using against the non-Muslims.
It's interesting given the population of Saudi Arabia. I mean, there are about, is it 20 million people total?
And, around, yes.
And then around half of those, so 10 million... are 25 and under. Do you see a big yes. generational divide?
Yes. Oh, my God. So we are one of the youngest nations in the world. Over 60% of us is under the age of 25. 80% of us under the age of 40. So we're a very young nation. And this young nation are people who are born in the 90s, the millennia, they are internet native, technology native. And that created a huge change. Do you know that we are number one in the world when it comes to consumption of YouTube videos?
No, I had no idea.
90 million views per day.
Wow.
So there is this thirst to get to know the other, to learn about other cultures, which is amazing. We have over 100,000 students studying abroad. Most of them are here in the United States. And I have hope those students, when they go back, they create change because they learn a lot of things. One of them is the basic right of freedom of speech, to speak up for yourself. I think the first female, the first female students who graduated from the U.S. went back in the year 2009, I think. And you can see the change now. That's so huge.
Mm-hmm. And Twitter and YouTube and Facebook were all really essential tools for you in this movement. They helped alert people that you had been arrested. It kind of ensured that you didn't disappear.
Yes.
Do you think in some ways it helped keep you alive?
Yes. Oh, my God. So when they arrested me, I asked my Ahmed. And Ahmed, I shout for Ahmed. He's one of my heroes. So Ahmed, he was the one behind the Twitter. He was running the Twitter account. Mm-hmm. And I sent him a message and I said, tweet about it. That really saved my life. And when I was arrested and when I was sent to jail the second time, it was too late at night. You would think everyone is asleep. No one would know when they arrested me at 2 a.m. But I made sure to call my sister-in-law. I begged and asked and plead to just have one phone call. And I wanted to have that phone call because it gave me I talked to my sister-in-law and I said, tell Ahmed to tweet about it. And she's like, what's tweet? I said, just tell him to tweet about it, that I'm in jail and in prison. Mm-hmm. I think also my amazing friend, Umar Al-Juhani, who was a neighbor, he was my neighbor. When they came to arrest me, he was hiding behind some bushes in front of my house. And he was tweeting and taking photos about it. At 2 a.m., imagine someone standing there tweeting about it. And he said, I got like 2,000 followers that night just by tweeting about your arrest. So Twitter is really creating a blanket or a shelter for us to not only voice our views, but also to when the danger time, at emergency time, we can use it.
So you were in jail for a while. They eventually released you and you were able to keep your job at Aramco for a little bit and eventually lost it.
Yes.
And in the book, you talk about how you interviewed at 47 other places in 2 years and got no offers because of your association with the activism.
Yes. So when I left my job, I thought, I'm like, I have a very good background. I have good experience. I'll find a job. I'll land a job in no time. But later I knew I moved to Dubai. And I was thinking Dubai will be more liberal than Saudi Arabia. But apparently my background or my public profile was not appealing because I work in information security and it's really critical. So I would do the interview and it would reach the HR. They send me rejected for confidential reasons. They would never tell me what confidential reasons until one of my friends who was a recruiter, she said, Manal, don't even think to apply for jobs in the UAE. You will not be accepted anywhere here. We moved now to Sydney. I'm hopeful that I can apply for a job and land a job. But it's sad that you prosecute people who speak up and you make their life really difficult. Something basic like finding a job can be impossible for them just because they are outspoken.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that, you know, for anyone listening to this thinking, why didn't you move sooner? It was hard for you to move, right? You had to get permission. You couldn't just leave the country on your own.
No. So first of all, I have a son from previous marriage. Mm-hmm. And I was harassed at work in the street. My family were harassed. But I kept going. It wasn't easy, really. I was treated like a criminal. It wasn't easy. The start of Aramco, they were fine. They were just stay quiet, don't do interviews. We don't want trouble. And then it got nasty later because I continued talking. So they moved me from my information security division. They moved me to another division. They dropped me from the special program that I created for information security. So I felt like it's not my place. I cannot stay quiet. And they threatened that I will be fired if I keep if I continue talking. So I had to give up my job to give a speech in Oslo Freedom Forum. I received the Václav Havel, the first Václav Havel Award for creative dissent. And that's the time when they said, we don't want our name to be associated with you. I said, thank you. If you don't want your name to be associated with me, I resign. So when I resigned, they took my house. I had a house loan. They took it from me. So I lost my job and my house at the same time. And my husband, my second husband, he proposed to me at that time. He said, we can just get married. But until today, we couldn't get our marriage approved. So we couldn't live in Saudi Arabia. We had to live in a country until temporary. But that temporary is now 5 years. Because I want to go back to live with my son. And I do believe the change cannot be created from outside. It has to be created from inside. When my book, no one wanted to buy my book in the Arab world. I'm very thankful to the U.S. because Simon & Schuster bought my book. Now I'm chasing the Arab publishers again. And I'm saying, this is the book. It's written. I want it to be published in Arabic. Because my audience, my main audience, are the Saudi women. I want them to speak up. I want them to have hope that things can be changed. We can stand against tyranny and against enslaving us.
Throughout the book and the dozens of interviews you've done with the press since, you frequently emphasize that you love your country.
Yes. I've been called a traitor. I've been called agent for the West. And I've been called someone who wants to corrupt Saudi woman. Disturb
the
public order.
And more things too, like a slut and a whore and...
You name it. Every name in the book, they used it. There is a special punishment reserved for the woman who speaks up. A special punishment is reserved for us women when we speak up. If a man speaks, he's fine. If a woman speaks, she's a bitch. That's the problem in around the world. It's a global problem. It's not only Saudi Arabia problem. And... the harassment were very huge in my country, not only for me, for any woman, because they wanted to set an example for other girls. She's corrupt. Don't follow her example. I'm happy to say I corrupted a lot of girls. A lot of girls speaking up today. A lot of girls are starting movements. They started this young generation. They started I Am My Own Guardian movement, and I joined the movement, and I'm supportive of that movement to end the enslavery of women in my country, considering the minors all their lives. So it is giving hope and is creating difference now.
So you're still hopeful that one day you'll be able to move back and drive?
I always emphasize this because, yes, they do question my background and they do question my belief and my heritage. So the message I deliver won't be heard. So I had to emphasize that I'm Saudi. I come from Saudi Arabia, and I do love Saudi Arabia, and I do love my country. Because I do love my country, I wanted to see the best, to stop treating women that way, because a country that keeps women at the back seat will end up in the wrong side of history. And I insist on driving, because for me, driving, nothing will emancipate women of my country, like driving. They will be independent. They will have the belief. They will have the switch when they turn on the car and be independent, be able to go to her work, do basic things in her life without the need of a man. That will end the guardianship system in my country.
Manal Al-Sharif is the author of Daring to Drive. She joined me today from New York. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for this interview.